The Goal Line Club brings you Gopher Gridiron Radio. If you are not a Goal Line Club member, make sure you go to GoalLineClub.org. Check out the memberships. Maybe you want to spruce up your resume. Become a member. You can be a Gopher football booster for only $100. Additionally, keep an eye on their Twitter. Keep an eye on their events page because there will be an event for a signing day social. So again, become a member today at GoalLineClub.org. And welcome to another episode of Gopher Gridiron Radio. I am Luke Buer. Okay, that lengthy pause was because there is no Ryan Burns. He is MIA, getting married for some reason. No, I kid. He is getting married for a very good reason to his lovely bride-to-be, Liz. And we're very excited for him. So I'm excited for one, in 283 episodes, Ryan Burns has made an appearance on every single one of those episodes. Today, he will not. And instead, it'll just be myself, Luke Buer, joined by Dinkytown Athlete Zone, Derek Burns. Derek, thank you for helping us out in Mr. Ryan Burns' absence. And once again, joining us for every single, or just about every single breakdown this year.
Well, thanks for having me back. I appreciate being back. We're going to miss Ryan, especially on a game where the Gopher special teams showed up and made a difference and maybe the key difference in the game.
I thought it was ironic that the one game he doesn't actually watch, you know, they maybe have one of their better performances of the entire year. I thought that the irony is just too rich for me in that specific instance. So yeah, we do want to get into this Gopher victory, 28-20 over the Syracuse Orange, an ACC opponent. The Gophers move on the 2022 season to 9-4 on the season. There's a lot to get into for the specific game and even for kind of the year in a whole. But I do think it's important that we have a quick conversation. We did this on the preview about how we should view bowl games in general, because I do think it's important, especially now in the age of both NIL and the transfer portal, that we should kind of construct a view or a lens of how we look at these games, Derek. So I'll start. Now, I look at bowl games now more than ever. I'm not saying they're not important. I do think they're important. I think they're important for fan bases. I think they're important for their rewarding programs and giving them the opportunity to continue to develop talent, especially younger talent. Those teams should absolutely be rewarded in some way, shape, or form. But frankly, the bowls outside of the playoff never to me have felt more like what's the word I'm probably looking for? It's effectively, you know, not a glorified scrimmage, but you know, I'm not even sure what to call it. I'm really struggling to find words, but it's not a game like the other 12 games are, just because rosters have changed so much, et cetera. It's a glorified exhibition game. Let's go with that.
Well, I think what you're trying to explain is the Gopher 2022 football team in effect did not play the Syracuse 2022 football team.
I think, no way, shape, or form. You know,
I think maybe that used to be the case. I mean, when, you know,
yes,
years ago, that was definitely more the case because of the consistency, which again, you're talking about change. You know, there was same coaches, same players. There wasn't the transfer portal. There wasn't the changes that we're seeing now. So I agree with you. Now I think there's different things we can take away and learn and have fun and, from it, but it's definitely different. I mean, there's no question. And I think as a fan, you know, the diehard college football fans, more college football is better. So there's still a place for bowl games. And I think there's still things to enjoy, but maybe the things that we're enjoying from it are different than they were before.
Yeah. And I want to make clear, like, I think the games have value, you know, being that they're effectively glorified exhibition games. I do mean that, but I mean, there's still value to the fan bases. They're still fun. I enjoy them, but like, I'm not going to really, I'm not going to really lump this into the 2022 season. I'm also not going to lump this into a launching point for the 2023 season. The other thing that I think is kind of a slippery slope in years past, I think 10 years ago, it was always fun to go like, okay, well now we get to see at the end of the season, let's compare the conferences. I feel like that has never been a worse comparison now, given how much change has happened in, you know, on these rosters and coaching staffs. Like, for instance, the Gophers were obviously without Michael Dixon. They were without Braylon Oliver. You know, Syracuse was without a number of players. They were without a number of coaches that had gone and taken other jobs, right? And so, like, trying to draw some conclusion on how strong conferences were, like, to me, that's basically a moot point now, because you just can't compare them at this juncture.
Yeah, and I think I would also finally, an additional point I would add is the way that the bowl selection happens now outside of the college football playoff and the New Year's Six bowls is completely different. So, you know, back in the day, it was the number three Big Ten team against the number three SEC team in the, you know, the Outback Bowl or the Citrus Bowl or whatever. So it was more of a head-to-head matchup of conference versus conference, where now we're all familiar, most of us, I think, are familiar with the fact that the bowl games outside of the New Year's Six are selected completely different. There are bowl contracts now. I mean, we just had the Pinstripe Bowl where the Gophers ended up in the Pinstripe Bowl because of the fact that the Pinstripe Bowl requires a certain number of different teams within a certain period of time. And basically there's more shuffling ultimately, where you're not necessarily slotted to go to a specific bowl game based on your finish in the conference. So I just think that lends more credence to what you're saying, and that you might see a much, much better team from Conference A playing a much more inferior team from Conference B just because of the way the bowl selections happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and before we get into this, you know, we mentioned too that you know, a number of Gophers have already entered the transfer portal. They've already made commitments to other schools, etc. And I know that it's early, and I know there's still another the transfer portal is still open, and there's even an official visit period here coming up that Mr. Burns is going to have to cover in some way, shape, or form once he gets back from his honeymoon. But I think it would be good before we start breaking down this game to just give some kind of general early observations of what we think of the transfer portal. This era is still relatively new. I'm going to throw out, Derek, just my general hypothesis that I've been running with for a while, and just kind of want to get your anecdotal impressions on the transfer portal. And just to remind people, I've said for a while, you know, we've seen effectively the transfer portal in a different form with much smaller number of athletes in college basketball, specifically with the grad transfer option, where we saw a number of players, and we even saw this some in high school recruiting, where athletes are trying to find the best fit for them. They're not always picking the helmet school, right? They're often trying to find a role that they want to play in a specific team. You know, they either want to be a starter or, you know, first guy off the bench or something like that, instead of basically being a practice kind of role player or scout team player. We've seen that in basketball for years. We've seen guys move up and down levels. We've seen guys, you know, take roles at different smaller universities where they had options to go to Power Five, etc. I think we're starting to see that some here in the transfer portal with college football as well. And I think that's what we see actually a lot in the open job market as well, where people are trying to find the best fit for them. And you know, they're not always necessarily trying to put that resume building, you know, Power Five conference on their specific resume that they played there, even though they might not have played a huge role. And again, that's kind of been my hypothesis. I think, Derek, what has your observation been thus far early in the transfer portal era?
Well, a couple things. I think what's getting a lot of attention certainly is NIL, and I think there's good reason for that. That's a factor that wasn't there before. Certainly, NIL is a factor in many cases, and when you're on the losing end, if you want to call it that, of a transfer that's you know, highly based on NIL, it certainly hurts. In their most fan bases have been negatively impacted in one way, shape, or form by transfers that are tied to NIL. So that's getting a lot of attention, and I do think that's a factor. But to me, objectively speaking, the number one thing that I'm seeing, the number one signal I'm seeing from the transfer portal, or trend, if you want to call it that, is players who are, if you're a high school recruit and you're not starting within 2 years at your position, you're very likely to lose that player. So what we're seeing at Minnesota and certainly elsewhere, again, if a player is even playing and not starting, or just maybe a rotational player, those players are looking to leave and maybe, like you said, go down a level, go to group of five, or you know, go just maybe not even down, but just at another place where there's a fit that they can be an every down player. And I think that's a signal we've seen in basketball, as you brought that up before, and I trust you on that. But we're certainly seeing that clear and strong in football. And so my two cents is, rather than talking about whether we hate that or that's good or that's bad, you know, I just think about how that is going to impact a program like Minnesota. And I don't want to say concerned, but I think that the potential for negative impact is that their depth is going to erode. So if you're going to lose your rotational players, again, I'm not just talking about Minnesota. I think this is a trend nationwide. If you're going to lose your rotational depth, that's going to catch up with you, or maybe with all teams, as the season progresses. Because unlike basketball, we've talked about this so many times when we break down games through the season, the last quarter, the last month of the football season, injuries are a huge impact. I mean, 22 starters that start the season at the beginning of the year, how many of them are out by the end of by November, for either permanently, right, or because of an injury? So I'm going to be interested to watch how this transfer portal era not only just impacts, you know, teams at different levels, but specifically from a depth perspective, because I'll just finish with this. Obviously the strategy then for a team like Minnesota is then to reach to, you know, like the Abilene Christian we've seen, and schools at that level reach down, if you want to call it down, and grab the stars from that level and bring them up, right? So if you're going to lose rotational guys, you'd hope that you can benefit from the transfer portal by bringing in, but yet those players you're reaching down to grab, you're reaching to fill a starting role. So I don't know that that's necessarily backfilling your depth. So maybe this ultimately, Luke, ends up being just more parity, because the talent's going to level out to some degree, but specifically how this is going to factor into a football team's depth in November is something I think to watch.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, if you follow the NFL closely, you know, success usually correlates very closely with how healthy teams are, and that's been true for basically the duration of the NFL. Rarely do those teams, because of both, you know, limits on limits on salary cap, as well as basically the number of rostered players they can keep. It just boils down to how healthy those teams are able to stay. And to that point, there is largely a lot of parity. And this is an interesting point that you bring up. Like, the depth is going to change, and it's going to be something to watch. In this specific game, though, Derek, this is where we were actually able to see the depth play a really, really big role for the Gophers, especially on defense, when you think about how many players they were down and didn't even play, right? This was kind of a next man up, as Ryan James wrote on Gopher Illustrated, and the Gophers were able to do that. So I actually want to start today with the Gopher defense, because so often we start with the Gopher offense, but we'll start with the Gopher defense today, because in my opinion, they were kind of the shining star of this game. And specifically, you saw this depth really stand out in this specific game, in which gave the Gophers the 28-20 victory. So maybe just start for us, Derek. You know, what were the Gophers trying to do in terms of stopping the Syracuse Orange offense?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd agree with you, and look forward to talking here in a minute about some of those young players, because I think that's part of the appeal now of bowl games that maybe we didn't have before. And as a symptom of this transfer portal era, I just think you're going to see younger players playing sooner. I mean, much like you've probably seen in basketball.
Yes,
but from a schematic perspective, I mean, Minnesota, they, as usual, they didn't buck a trend. They wanted to play a soft zone, play mostly zone coverage. They mixed it up from time to time, but in effect, challenge Syracuse by being able to throw into his own coverage and you know, up front, run stopping was, you know, is always first and foremost in running down the distances. And I would say that the Gophers, you know, they struggled in different facets with Syracuse's offense really throughout the game. And Syracuse was able to rack up a number of yards, but ultimately ended up that explosive plays or big plays on defense is what you mentioned, you know, kind of left them being the hero in the game. But from a schematic perspective, Syracuse, I think, did a good job on offense by trying to force Minnesota to defend the whole field. Mm-hmm. And I know we'll talk about field conditions in a minute. That became critically important in the game because it was even more difficult to defend the whole field. But effectively, their offense with their QB counter, outside zone play action, which all run off of the same look, gave Minnesota problems. I think that Minnesota wants to be a read, diagnose, and react defense. So Syracuse challenged Minnesota's defense by being able to stop a whole bunch of different looks out of the same, you know, personnel and package and be able to defend a lot of the field without doing as much blitzing and aggression. And they did more of that as the game went on and kind of, you know, broke their tendency. But that was the way Syracuse attacked it, and they had, you know, success at times, but they were not consistent enough because Minnesota defense was able to come up with enough big plays.
Yeah, on the day, the Syracuse Orange had 477 total yards. 330 of those came through the air, and 147 of those came on the ground. Their quarterback, Schrader, was 32 of 51 for 330 yards and an interception. On the day as well, they amassed 27 first downs. They were 7 of 16 on third down and 1 of 3 on fourth down. And you know, the Gophers effectively, as they've done most of the season, they dare teams, Derek, to basically you know, have to go long distances on them and amass long sustaining drives, which, you know, at times didn't work particularly well, especially as the Orange would get into the red zone, for instance, where they ended up having to settle for two field goals. But I think this is a point in a strategy that I know you've talked about a lot, where, you know, the Gopher defense is predicated on just trying and working to basically not give up big plays, and for the most part they were able to do that on it's not, I always want to say Saturday because I'm so used to it, but yeah. But on Thursday evening,
yeah, I wanted to make a comment about, you know, Minnesota, it's no secret that they want to play coverage, so particularly in defending the pass, they have shown a tendency, and what they do is they rush four, if not only three, you know, rushers, and then they play coverage with seven or eight defenders in the secondary. And I have to give some credit to Schrader, the Syracuse quarterback. While he wasn't consistent, and he did make a critical error with the pick six, which was also a good play on the, you know, part of Coleman Bryson, he was able to hit some windows in the zone from time to time that really hurt Minnesota, and were able to, you know, keep the chains moving from time to time. And I'm specifically thinking end of the first half. I mean, this game might have been completely different. I think Minnesota's up two scores and Syracuse gets the ball back with a couple minutes to go. And, you know, unfortunately for Minnesota's defense, they marched right down the field, and he was able to hit a number of windows to get them down for a touchdown going into halftime, and then Syracuse getting the ball coming out of the second half. So sometimes when you watch as a fan, and your defense is struggling in one way, shape, or form, it's certainly human nature to say that's a failure on your defense. I think there were some breakdowns, but you have to give credit. Sometimes it's the result of the offense being executed well also. So Schrader on the offensive side for Syracuse was a problem for the Gophers. And even running the ball, I know the numbers weren't gaudy and his QBR yeah. wasn't gaudy, but again, inconsistently, if that makes any sense, he was able to really hurt the defense from time to time, but just as you said, not enough big plays, and wasn't able to do it consistently enough to to get the win.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is we were texting, you know, during the specific game, and Schrader, from a running standpoint, reminded me a lot of Mitch Leidner. He wasn't like the fastest guy, you know, at the quarterback position, but he found ways to be efficient. He found his way into the end zone. He was tough to bring down. He was a big kind of plodding running back. I thought in general, you know, that is something that can hurt the Gopher defense, specifically when you're not accounting for a running quarterback at all times and you don't have that speed, because they're only rushing, you know, three or four, and because they're playing coverage, that makes it very difficult to defend.
Yeah, and some of those, I mean, in particular, some of those like second and third and medium, you're right. I mean, when you're dropping eight into coverage, and particularly deep coverage, it was frustrating to see that quarterback who you just nailed it during the game. I couldn't find the words to explain, you know, this kind of lumbering quarterback who kept getting first downs. And you just nailed it when he said, boy, this is like the ghost of Mitch Leidner. But he was, again, in critical situations, he was able to pick up with his legs a couple first downs, and in other times scramble around and avoid a sack or two, and able to complete a pass for first down. So again, credit to that young man, who again, wasn't perfect, but at times was able to do pretty well. And I will say, from a schematic standpoint, you know, the Gophers in the second half in particular did end up bringing more pressure.
Yes.
Not always, but they really did well with that. So I think the lesson here is that Syracuse coaching staff, and I know there were coaching vacancies, so I don't know who exactly was running the ship, but credit to them that they did a good job of putting together a game plan, knowing that Minnesota likes to play coverage. They don't want to be aggressive if they don't have to be. And Syracuse came out with a game plan that really forced Minnesota and basically said, if you want to stop us, you're going to have to blitz more and you're going to have to be more aggressive. Otherwise, we're going to kind of pick you apart. And they were able to do that for the most part, but Minnesota dialed up a little more pressure. You know, the interception, Coleman Bryson, I want to give credit to not only him, but Joe Rossi. The Gophers had played just a standard cover two and a soft edge, and Syracuse just kept hitting over and over again, kept hitting the slot out route, which, you know, normally the inside linebacker has to cover it, and it's why they were able to hit it time and again, because the split receiver is pushing the safety down the field, which provides that gap in the zone. And so they had gone back to that over and over and over again. And again, credit to Joe Rossi and his staff. They switched up the coverage. They brought press coverage on the outside. They brought Coleman Bryson down in that pocket. And the quarterback read the linebacker exactly as he had previously, but didn't account for, he thought Coleman Bryson would be pushed off with a slot receiver route. And instead he stayed short and jumped the route and picked six. So, you know, good play by the young man. Certainly, I don't want to take anything away from him, but it was also a key schematic change that made a big difference in the game.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into, you know, the Gophers were down a number of guys on defense, whether that was the transfer portal or injury. Again, we talked about Flip Dixon as well as Braylon Oliver, but keep in mind that Tyler Newbin, who we thought might play, actually didn't play. So insert Coleman Bryson as well as Darius Green. Both of those guys had phenomenal days. Bryson ends up being the MVP, and in this game, I did look here while we were recording, he did burn his red shirt playing in this game, so this was his fifth game. So the true freshman will be a true sophomore next year, and I imagine he's going to play a pretty big role. I know Ryan talked about it coming into the season, you know, Coleman Bryson was really impressing, and you know, I think we saw flashes of that now, especially here in the bowl game, taking that MVP. But in general, you know, there was the injury to Cody Lindenberg as well. You saw Donald Willis step in. You even saw, you saw other guys, you know, mixing in as well. The fact that there were a couple guys that I thought flash at times, Darnell Jeffries, who didn't always play huge numbers of snaps this year, had a couple times he flashed. Obviously, Jalen Logan Redding had a couple moments as well. But I do have to say, you know, the fact that this defense was able to just, you know, have a next man up mentality, and really you didn't see a lot of drop off per se. It always helps to have some experience around them, but you know, the future can look somewhat bright, knowing that, you know, you had some of these younger guys jump into the bowl game and play big roles, Derek.
Yeah. I mean, we got to witness firsthand the, you know, the growing up of some of these players. I mean, on the field in a game, you know, against a Power 5 opponent, you know, and I think there was a lot of up and down. I mean, we've talked about this before, but, you know, the progression of a player is, you know, they first have to understand what their assignment is. And, you know, second is how to execute that, their technique. And the third part is effort. And if you don't have the first two down, your effort doesn't matter. Your effort, your athleticism, your speed, whatever, doesn't matter if you're not running the right assignment and you're not using the right technique. So generally with young players, you see flashes of that speed and athleticism, but it's not always 100% sound on the reading and diagnosing part. And that's exactly what we saw in the secondary. I mean, I can think of, you know, Darius Green early in the game, he gets completely faked out by a reverse, doesn't read the play correctly. And that reverse ends up going for a big gain because he wasn't able to read it. And he still thinks that the running back had the ball, but then, you know, another series later, he's blowing up a bubble screen because he reads it well. And his closing speed is really impressive. So if you're a Gopher fan, you know, you want to look at that speed and those flashes and the athleticism, because that's what coaching, they'll bring them along. The coaching and the experience will learn the assignment better. They'll learn with more experience. They will get the reading and diagnosing down and limit more of those, you know, limit those mental mistakes less and be able to focus. So if you can see in the case of Darius Green, I mean, again, I'll say more time, his closing speed, whether it be on a run fit or on a passing, that gives you some big hope there, because as he's able to see more formations, more plays, get more game action, his reading and diagnosing is going to become quicker. And Coleman Bryson, same thing. I mean, early in the game, he's playing a little bit soft on cover two. He gives up inside leverage, gave up a couple slants because he just hasn't seen those game routes before, and he's not able to jump those necessarily or get a pass breakup. And so he gives up a few plays, you know, playing soft coverage. But as the game goes on, he's able to react, you know, see, once you've seen the same play two or three times or the same formations, you're now able to react quicker and be able to become the MVP of the bowl game ultimately.
Yeah. And ultimately too, you know, we saw a number of guys step up, and there's reason to be optimistic about this defense going into next year. There's a lot that can still change given the transfer portal, injuries, et cetera. But going into spring, I think there are some guys you can be really excited about. We saw Cody Lindenberg go off with injury, but to me, he and Tyler Newbin seem to be the two that'll probably headline this defense along with Ja Joyner. You've got, you know, you've kind of got three guys that look like budding stars or are already stars, you know, stepping into those roles. Are there other guys, you know, coming back that excite you? Maybe this is too early a question because we don't know what's going to happen. But are there other guys, you know, I think the obvious ones are Lindenberg, Ja Joyner, and Tyler Newbin. But any others that kind of stood out that you're excited to see in spring ball?
I think Donald Willis will be interesting. I mean, he's, again, a guy that's shown flashes in a number of games and maybe was one of those rotational players we've talked about. Some games he's getting two snaps and other games he's getting, you know, in the teens, something like that. And so I think they're going to look for him to make more of an impact, certainly with Braylon Oliver exiting. And I would also say just the defensive line as a whole. I mean, I think there's going to be youth on the defensive line, and they're, you know, whether another year with Trill Carter, Ja Joyner, you know, those guys getting more experience, more reps. I think that's going to be key to look at that and see if they're going to stick with, you know, a lot of the same game plan where you're using a 4-man rush, sometimes a 3-man rush. Boy, if you're able to get a little bit more pressure out of that, that's going to, you know, make things even better from a pass defense perspective.
Yeah. To add to that, I was really impressed at times in flashes with both Jalen Logan Redding and Danny Strigoi. I would have added Gage Keys, but see, he's already moved on. But you know, those two, I'm excited to see another year, you know, of development from them and an opportunity for them to grow. Obviously Darius Green and Coleman Bryson, which we've already talked about. The other thing I want to highlight is, I've said this before, and I will say this again. In the transfer portal era, it very often can be tempting to move and, you know, not go through adversity and improve. And I just want to, again, give Terrell Smith a shout out for the improvement that he's made over his career, especially when he knocked down the depth chart and he had a phenomenal season this year, going through and just, you know, betting on himself and effectively mm-hmm. becoming a better player for it. He deserves credit as well. Another player that one I really enjoyed in his social media, you know, but also a leader on the defense that will be missed, obviously, is Mariano Sorry Marin. You know, they featured him in a lot of social media stuff with the food stuff in camp. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was kind of fun. Props to Gopher Digital and what they've been able to do. Some of those are very entertaining. But, you know, he's been kind of a heart and soul of the defense, and he moves on. He did have a pretty nice game. He still had some of the challenges that you'd often see, but in the end, he ended up with 10 tackles, you know, in 1.5 TFLs. So, you know, he had a pretty good showing. He's going to be a tough one to basically replace, more so from kind of the heart and soul of that defense. I mean, you probably can talk about that more and how difficult that is to replace, Derek.
Well, yeah, he's the quarterback of the defense. I mean, he has been now, and I mean, kind of maybe an overall theme here is it's really the end of an era for Gopher football. When you think about Mariano Sorry Marin, Tanner Morgan, Mo Ibrahim, because of this extra, you know, COVID year of eligibility, you have a number of players who have been around for a very long time and have played in a huge number of games. And I think you're right, and I don't think you can understate it from a mental perspective, from a leadership on the field perspective. That is important. I mean, we know that, and I think even more important in a Joe Rossi defense, which, as we said before, is predicated on being gap sound, getting players in the right position, lined up correctly pre-snap, and then, you know, playing their run fit or pass, you know, pass zone, whatever their assignment is, getting that right. And just, you know, not being mistake free, because that doesn't exist, but essentially limiting mistakes and limiting big plays. So yeah, Mariano mm-hmm. being the quarterback of the defense, and those are going to be big shoes to fill. I mean, Cody Lindenberg, you know, is another guy that, I mean, the ceiling is incredibly high for Cody from, mm-hmm. from an athletic perspective. The sky is the limit, really. I mean, and he's still, you know, growing and maturing and getting more experience and built upon that huge athleticism he has. So, you know, if he's a guy that steps in as kind of the quarterback or some, whether it's him or someone else, that is something they're going to need to get for sure.
All right, my last kind of just shout out would be for Jordan Howden. What a career he's had, but just think about the improvement he's made, you know, over his career coming in. I believe he came in as a walk-on earning a scholarship, you know, playing very early. He too had a really good 2022 here. And man, he's going to be another one that'll be missed. Hoping he gets an opportunity or a shot at the next level, whether that be the NFL or one of the other professional football leagues. But he's going to be another guy that's going to be hard to replace. But you know, you do have some real skill there. you do have some real skill there that's very young as well.
Yeah, I would echo that, and just maybe we shouldn't harp on it too much. But again, in this new era of college football, you still have to remember another you know factor here is that these are college athletes, and they grow and change and mature and get better very rapidly. I mean, much more compared to the NFL. So, you know, you do have players like Jordan Howden and Tyler Newbin that struggled, you know, with certain aspects of the game when they were young. And now look at where they are. I mean, Tyler Newbin is, you know, getting the postseason accolades that he deserves. And Jordan Howden is just the rock of the secondary that you talk about mistake free has just been exceptional. And then you flip it over on offense too, and there are examples of that as well. So it's going to be interesting, because again, I'm not trying to make a case or an argument for players transferring or not transferring, but yeah, you do look at players like Terrell Smith that he could have easily gone somewhere else, and who knows what would have happened, but he stuck around and he's become an every down, you know, lockdown cover corner for a Big Ten Power Five football team. So it worked out for him. It worked out for Jordan. It worked out for Tyler and a number of guys, because the player they were as a freshman is certainly not the player they are now.
Once again, we want to thank the Goal Line Club for being a proud supporter of Gopher Gridiron Radio for this 2022 Gopher football season. We appreciate their support, but more importantly, we appreciate how they support Golden Gopher football. If you want to support Golden Gopher football, the best way to do that is to be a member of the Goal Line Club. Go to goalineclub.org to become a member today. Additionally, keep an eye out on their Twitter, at Goal Line Club. Again, their Twitter is at Goal Line Club. Very simple. Follow them. You'll get news updates for events, etc. Additionally, keep an eye on their website, goalineclub.org/glc-events. There you will see an upcoming event for the signing day social. Always a very enjoyable event. Again, keep an eye on goalineclub.org/glc-events, as well as Goal Line Club on Twitter. Okay, Derek, let's talk a little bit about when the Gophers were on offense. On the day, the Gophers amassed 28 points. We should mention that 7 of those came from the defense. So the Gophers were able, the Gopher offense was able to outscore the Syracuse Orange 21-20. But on the day, you know, the Gophers, you know, more or less somewhat what you would expect out of them. You know, they ran the ball 33 times, but it was, you know, only for 71 yards. Mohammed Ibrahim amassed 71 of those yards before they shut him down in the first, after the first half, after he reached all of his milestones, which we probably should take a minute there to just actually bask in, you know, the end of Mo Ibrahim, the, you know, all-time leading rusher, all-time season leading, all-time season in touchdowns, like the accolades go on and on and on for someone that Ryan Burns was saying early in his career should get fewer touches to turn out into be what he is now is really impressive what he's been able to do from scout player of the year all the way to, you know, to first team all conference. And man, what a joy it was to watch him and coming back from that brutal Achilles injury was even just icing on the cake. The fact that he was able to come back and perform at even a higher level than expected, Derek, was just surreal.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it is a shame that Ryan's not with us so that we can remind him one more time.
Yeah, one last time.
That he was right. Yeah, one last time that how wrong he was about Mo Ibrahim. But I have defended Ryan on that in the past, and it was the speech I just gave, I think, applies to Mo, and that here's a guy that was able to improve incredibly and certainly was overlooked. There's no doubt. But got better and found his niche and just maximized his potential beyond, you know, anything I think many of us or any of us expected, including the coaches. But there's a lot to say about Mo. He certainly is, you know, firmly implanted on the Mount Rushmore, if you want to call it that, of Gopher running backs in history. I don't think there's any arguing that, but there's a lot we could say. I guess the two things I would say are, number one, best vision of any running back I've ever seen in my lifetime for a Gopher, wear a Gopher uniform. If you think about why he was able to do what he did, you know, there's a lot of compliments you can throw out there, but vision, I think, was unparalleled. And the second thing, which you already touched on, was, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we were speculating what type of Mo Ibrahim would we see coming off an Achilles injury. I mean, we really, you know, going into the season, that was an open question. Are we gonna, you know, are we gonna see a 75% Mo or a 60% Mo or an 80% Mo? And you know, against all odds and all speculation, Mo was objectively better after his Achilles injury this year than he was at any point in his career, which is just, I mean, that's a tribute to him as a person, as I can't imagine the amount of rehab and, you know, medical staff that treated him. I mean, it's a credit to the medical staff, the coaching staff and everybody, but I just think that needs to be stated that, yes, medical science gets better and better, and these young athletes are more and more athletic, and they can bounce back from injuries. better than they have in generations past. I get that. But being able to do what he did coming off an Achilles injury and be better, that have his best season, it's, you know, that it's just one more thing to say about him as he goes out here, is just how amazing that is.
All right, so let's take a quick look at the stats for the Gophers. When they are on offense, they only amassed 215 yards of total offense on 49 plays. They were 11 of 16 through the air for 77 yards. And, you know, they ran the ball 33 times for only a 2.3 yard average. Now, you look at that and you go to yourself, well, how the heck did they win this game, especially that they lost the time of possession? You know, they only had the ball for almost 26 minutes. You know, on third downs, they were sub 50%. They were 5 of 11. You know, they just didn't put up a lot of numbers offensively. But I think, Derek, I think the important thing that we have to note is the Gophers were able to generate some explosive plays. And one, we already talked about, that was on defense and scoring a touchdown. But, you know, that punt or that kick return was huge for them. The fact that it put them in good scoring position, and then they were able to just execute and finish and get touchdowns and not field goals.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a flip the script game for Minnesota, where, and I know we'll talk about this later as we close out, but Minnesota has really hung their hat on being a consistent team. I mean, that's the way they've earned their success on offense, is being incredibly consistent and moving the chains and being able to control the clock and control the game and win the line of scrimmage. And maybe have been lacking in the explosive plays area for one reason or another. And again, this was kind of a flip the script game where there really wasn't a lot of consistency on offense, partly because Syracuse made big schematic changes, which we can go into, partly because Ethan got injured and Tanner did an excellent job coming in. But that's a big change for an offense to take on. And the rhythm of the game was just very, you know, the field... You know, the field conditions certainly played into it, and I know it affects both teams, but that also kept teams from being consistent. So,
oh, yeah.
You're absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're right, Luke, that I think that there's a case to be made that the pick six, the explosive kick return, and then the slip screen for a touchdown coming after the kick return, those three plays may have just sealed up the game right there. I mean, with all else, you know, that occurred. So, offensively, from a schematic standpoint, you know, Syracuse started the game, and this was just a head scratcher. It kind of reminded me of last year in the Guaranteed Rate Bowl. Syracuse wanted to play a quarters really, really big cushion, soft zone defense, which I don't, you know, I think they run a 3-3-5. I don't know why you would frankly run that against a team like Minnesota. So the first couple series, Minnesota just basically mowed them over in the running game. I mean, I'm thinking of Jamison Greer's on the edge, just destroying the defensive ends on the backside of inside zone. And Minnesota ran that strong side toss play that they had run in the past, and really just kind of ran up and down the field on Syracuse with that scheme. But obviously their coaching staff made big changes after that, and they ended up bringing up a number of defenders on the line of scrimmage, run blitzing quite a bit more, and specifically brought up defenders on the running back side of the offense. So if you think back to, I can't remember, Luke, if it was the Iowa game or what game it was, but the chess match that occurred where Minnesota started flipping the running back from one side of the quarterback the other, because so a little bit of that went on here as well, where Syracuse overloaded the running back side because they're trying to take away the cutback on inside zone and take away that strong side toss, which they did for the most part. But Minnesota then, you know, with the blitzing and such, it was kind of became, you know, their approach was, as it usually is we have a lead. We still want to control the ball, but I have to give credit to Kirk Shiraka that recognizing those blitzes finally went late in the game to the slip screen to Daniel Jackson. And that was just the absolute perfect play call against that scheme to let them blitz from the running back side, let that blitz come in and then throw the screen behind it, end up being a touchdown. So hopefully that's a signal or a sign of things to come, where if defenses are going to scheme up to take away the run, that we're able to shift to things like that to create explosive plays.
Yeah, and let's highlight the fact that, and I know that Mo had a, you know, had a really good first half and didn't play the whole game. You know, he's 16 for 71 and 4.4 yards and a touchdown. But you have to make the argument that with even with only four receptions, that Daniel Jackson was probably the offensive MVP in this game from a specialist perspective. I mean, the catch he made for the touchdown, one, it's a beautiful throw from Tanner Morgan for that first touchdown, but he makes that, you know, a completely a contested catch. Ryan Burns would just be absolutely giddy that somebody made a contested catch, yep. Right? But that was phenomenal. The guy, I mean, he was blatantly interfered with, I thought. Ended up losing his helmet as they tussled for the ball when he was already had it. But, you know, his four receptions for 73 yards and two touchdowns were really what made the game. Both of those, both touchdowns were really really explosive plays, right? Go ahead.
And I was going to say, a big compliment to him, or the best compliment I can give to him, is the variation of routes that he ran. And that's maybe, again, a sign of things to come. I mean, you think about the touchdown was a slot fade, which is, you know, it was a 50-50 ball. That slot fade, that's been the bane of Ryan's existence for part of the season. They were able to hit it for a touchdown. Great pass, by the way, from Tanner on that play. But again, good route, good 50-50 ball from Daniel Jackson. The slip screen, obviously, we talked about, which is a completely different route. And then one of his bigger catches in the second half was a double move. And normally, when you think of double move, you think of like an out and up or stop and go or something like that. But he ends up running, faking a post. So he takes a post break, but then he breaks off his post into a shallower slant. And I think on that play, they went max protect. The Gophers only had two receivers out in routes. And I believe Syracuse had six or seven defenders back there. So in a zone. So credit to Daniel. He's able to run a double move, get the safety pressed on that post pattern, and then break it off into a shallower slant and get a catch underneath the safety against, you know, five defenders in the middle of the field. So I agree with you 100%. He had a great game and was definitely the bright spot on the passing game, and hopefully a sign of things to come. And when you have a player that versatile that's able to make catches and isn't one-dimensional, I mean, a lot of wide receivers are, you know, they're good at one or two routes, and, you know, they just aren't, they're not competitive in other situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really limits you, but it was nice to see Daniel be so successful in different routes.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit. I mean, we touched on Tanner. Like, number one, it was awesome to see him come back, be effective, make one really incredible throw, that one to Daniel Jackson on the slot fade. But then, you know, also had the touchdown to Daniel Jackson on the slip screen as well. You know, he was 4 for 7, 58 yards. Not a lot asked of him. Didn't turn over the ball in very Tanner Morgan-esque fashion. You know, was able to protect it, and that was important in this specific game. But, you know, we also saw Ethan Calliope-Manis play. He was 7 of 9 for 80 yards before he was injured. He didn't do much in the running game to start, but you see kind of the dichotomy between the two, right? Ethan, mm-hmm. definitely the bigger arm, definitely the more of the athlete, etc. You know, I think everybody kind of held their breath when he went down, thinking that it could be a knee. It sounds like it's not particularly serious, and that we'll probably learn more, obviously, as spring ball comes around. But I mean, again, one, Tanner, amazing career, and two, I mean, the future does look bright with Ethan, and it's something to build around, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple things I wanted to say about Tanner. I mean, I gave a couple points on Mo, and, you know, when I think about Tanner, this might sound like a little bit of a backhanded compliment, and I certainly don't mean it that way, but number one, his durability. I mean, up until, you know, dealing with some concussion issue, what seemed to be concussion issues at the end of this season, an extremely durable player that, look at the number of starts he was able to put together at a Big Ten level, where, you know, before Tanner entered the picture, the Gophers hadn't gone how many games without playing two different quarterbacks. Right. So he became, from a durability perspective, you could count on him nearly every single week. So I think that's a credit to him. The other thing, which again, I don't want it to sound like a backhanded compliment, I think it's undervalued, is his ability to not hurt the offense. And I don't think it was that he was just a prototypical game manager or that he didn't have the skills. He definitely had skills, but his just not making mistakes was huge. I mean, the Gophers, you know, obviously in his era, they ran RPO extremely well, but they ran the ball extremely well. Mm-hmm. So he certainly didn't get in the way of that. He didn't. I mean, the number of quarterbacks at college and to a lesser degree, the NFL level that have phenomenal skills but make critical errors.
Yeah.
I mean, there's those guys are a dime a dozen, you know, mm-hmm. great arm talent, great body, fast, but they can't read a defense or they can't, you know, they make mistakes and throw interceptions or they're careless with the ball. I mean, those guys don't stick around. So I think those two things are a huge credit to Tanner.
I do want to piggyback off that where, you know, to your point that he didn't hurt the Gophers. You know, he might go down, and this is not something that you can quantify or measure, as one of the smartest Gopher quarterbacks. I shouldn't say Gopher quarterbacks. Just one of the smartest quarterbacks, because in the end, playing the position of quarterback it's so much more mental sometimes than people really realize, right? When it comes mm-hmm. to like pre-snap, post-snap reads, you know, he arguably was pretty good at that. His challenge was moving off of that first read and progressing off of that. We saw that some early in this season. And we also saw that some in 2020 and 2019 as well. I mean, he's the all-time winningest Gopher quarterback from a percentage mm-hmm. standpoint. You can't undervalue that. But his smarts, I think, is really, you know, where he maybe lacks some of the athleticism or the arm talent, it really differentiates him. And you know, the smarts really can make you successful, especially at the high school ranks. But it's a minimum requirement at the collegiate or, you know, at the collegiate level. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll get a lot of coaches that will hope that they can develop those smarts and they can train that into a much more athletic quarterback. That I think rarely actually comes to fruition. Right. And that's a testament.
There's only so much. Yeah. There's only so much you can. Yes. You can learn in that area. Definitely.
Yeah. So ultimately, I mean, props to him. He, you know, I also just want to make sure that I highlight that, you know, everything that he's gone through in his personal life, you know, sticking it through and having, you know, a phenomenal career, he deserves, you know, all the credit in the world. There's just gonna be no denying he is the winningest Gopher quarterback in school history, and that was just really incredible, awesome to him. And I wish him all the best. I'm very curious to see what he ends up doing. Just given how smart he was pre-snap and post-snap and reading defenses, I'm curious mm-hmm. to see if he doesn't end up in that coaching ranks.
Yeah, it's the obvious move seems to be coaching, doesn't it? And I mean, that's whether that's at the college level or I don't know, who knows, you know, he hasn't, you know, he's been pretty private about that. And I don't know if he wants to pursue a professional career. And, you know, people might think, well, I don't know if he's cut out for the NFL. Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe there are other leagues that maybe he still wants to play. Who knows? But he definitely, you nailed it. He has the football mind to be able to play and coach, and certainly coach for a long time. So it'll be, you know, we're all wishing him well. I think time is going to reflect very positively on Tanner. I think it's fair to say that a portion of the fan base, and I'm not knocking them, got a little bit impatient, you know, with Minnesota being able to run the ball so well and play well on defense. I think people really pined for an elite passing game. And for reasons that I don't think were entirely Tanner's fault, they weren't able to get over the hump at times in passing the ball. But with some time, I think looking back again on this kind of era of Gopher football and the wins they've had and the bowl wins and some of the rivalry wins against Wisconsin, I think people are going to remember Tanner really fondly.
Yeah, a couple things I wanted to note. What a catch by Bryce Williams on that third down. That was a phenomenal shoestring catch, right above his shoestrings there. That was a phenomenal grab. Also, what the heck happened where that ball just like died so quick? I think we'll never know that. Like it looked like it was going to be on a decent trajectory and it just like dove down. Another one to, to highlight. One, Brevin Spanford will be back. I gotta imagine he'll be featured more. But what an incredible season from him in terms of being able to develop as a run blocker in this specific role that, you know, we never saw before. The future is still bright for him, especially coming back for one more season. Curious to see, you know, what his post playing career will be like. But man, he's a weapon that will be nice to have next season.
Yeah, it was. I'm just chuckling, thinking of the differences now in Ethan as compared to Tanner. And, you know, early in the game, I think they're definitely going to use Brevin big time, specifically in some of the zone routes to attack the middle of defenses with just, you know, stop routes and pocket routes where it's going to force coverage off of the wide receivers. And I'm thinking early in the game, really just kind of a routine incomplete pass where Ethan, I think, has a little bit of stubbornness, and maybe that's a good thing because he trusts his arm so well that, you know, Brevin sits in on a pocket and there's really no business in throwing the ball to Brevin because they're covering it. And Ethan still tries to get the ball in there. I mean, he just reels back and rifles it in as hard as he can because he just believes I'm going to get the ball in there, and ended up being knocked down. It didn't hurt him necessarily, but they are definitely going to feature Brevin next year. And I think they'll move him around a lot. You saw that as the season went on, they put him in the slot more. They split him out from time to time. He's still an incredible run blocker, so they'll use him there for sure. But yeah, play action and some of those zone routes are going to be fun to watch with he and Ethan.
Yeah. And at wide receiver, we don't know what what's going to happen with, you know, some of the transfers they're bringing in, et cetera, and some of the young talent. But Lamecki Brockington, even though he had a drop, definitely seems to kind of have found a role. He and Ethan seem to have a little bit of a rapport. He obviously did much better when Ethan was in. Mm-hmm. And then also I wanted to highlight Dalen Wright. You know, he only had 2 catches for 14 yards. And I'm not trying to make an excuse for Dalen, but I would imagine on that goal ball, if they were playing on turf or a more sustainable field, he either gets a PI or makes that catch. You know, like that to me was very funny.
There was nobody more disgusted with their body language, at least if you're reading their body language, with the field conditions than Dalen Wright. I mean, when he got up from, I mean, he didn't stomp his feet or throw a tantrum, but yeah, that 50-50 ball where he goal ball where he, you know, went back shoulder, and he had every intention in the world of planting his foot and going back and going up and catching the ball for an explosive gain. And obviously the footing just completely gave out on him, and the way he looked when he got up, just like, you know, are you kidding me? You know, I mean, he just had that, like, exactly, you got to be kidding me look, you know, as he trotted off the field, which, you know, I think the fans collectively agreed with him on that one.
Yeah. All right. I think we have to talk about special teams to some extent. Quentin Redding had a big 72-yard kickoff return, which was very big in setting up the second touchdown, which ended up being the slip screen. Again, from a special teams perspective, explosive play that, you know, makes a difference. So you really have explosive plays in all three phases, both offense, defense, and special teams, that all basically result in points. You know, that's the key. And I would argue in this specific game, special teams really didn't hurt them. It was an added benefit, which is something that we haven't seen all year.
Well, I don't know. You saw that maybe this was a game to do a little bit of experimenting with special teams. We've certainly criticized very harshly the Gophers' lack of creativity in special teams and lack of willingness to go away from the same strategies. And I know I can tell you in punt return, we saw Quentin Redding run up. I mean, you're going to laugh, but he actually ran up and caught a couple of punts rather than letting it bounce in front of him and staying risk averse. So whether that was a strategy, you know, this game to try and, you know, do that where they hadn't done that before, it certainly worked out for them. Didn't backfire on them at all. And then, you know, obviously the kick return for the explosive gain where they faked an end around or faked a, an end around. Yeah. And that not only faking the end around, but that was also a sideline return. And Minnesota, I think, has run middle return on every single, if not 90%+ of their kick returns. So being able to run a sideline return, throw in the fake reverse, it definitely paid off for him. Obviously, Syracuse was not ready for that because they had not shown it on film. I guess I'm, you know, so encouraging if you want to take away from, you know, they tried out a few things, they seem to work well. Hopefully that's a sign that they'll be a little bit more dynamic in the special teams game next year. I guess my what I'm left with, I don't want to spin this negative, but I'm just kind of left saying why did they wait to do, you know, looking at the kicker. I mean, you know, why did we wait? Why not throw that out against, you know, Iowa or Wisconsin or, you know, another, and I know the kick coverage, the argument maybe is that those kick coverage teams are better and you don't think you're going to be able to pull it off. Okay, fine. But I don't know. What do you have to lose in some of these situations to not throw a couple wrinkles in there on special teams?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, on the day Matthew Trickett was 4 for 4, he didn't get any extra, or sorry, he didn't get any field goal attempts. In certain ways, that's really good because your offense is scoring or your defense is scoring. Yeah. And then conversely, Mark Crawford, 6 punts. He averaged 43 yards. He had a long of 55. Really kind of a mixed bag day for him. I think consistency has still been a struggle for him. He has a tendency to hit a really low ball, which has a tendency to make it very challenging. He does work directionally, and sometimes puts the returner in a bad position where they can't even really return it, so they call a fair catch. But, you know, he did have 3 inside the 20, but none of them were really great. You know, that's a position you feel like they can definitely do better at. Curious to see what they'll do going forward. All in all, you know, the explosive play is going to be, when you look at special teams, is going to be the net benefit in terms of what made them, you know, more of a positive than a negative in this game script overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, punting, I would agree with you that the best punt they had was a directional punt. They got a good roll. He got a good roll on it, but it's a credit to him that, you know, he got it away from the returner and was able to pick up more yards on it. But yes, that stuck out to me too, lower trajectory. And maybe that's just, frankly, just a leg strength thing where if you kick it with a higher trajectory, you're only going to be kicking a 30-yard punt. I'm not sure. But
yeah,
I would go as far as to say that they won the special teams battle, if you want to call it that. Yeah. And that it definitely ended up being a net benefit for them. So, boy, if they can get more of that next year where, you know, it's a push or a net benefit on special teams, that's certainly going to be a welcome change.
All right. I recognize that one thing I did miss that I wanted to make sure we talked about, and I did miss when we talked about offense, was that offensive line. You know, you saw John Michael Schmidt not play the consensus All-American at center. And frankly, I think that's the right move for him. You know, he got injured in that bowl game last year. He's looking onto a pro career where he has a chance to be a top 60 pick, probably. Really glad he didn't play given those field conditions. And Nathan Bowe stepped in. I thought, you know, Bowe did pretty well, all things considered. You know, I do have a question for you though. On the one that the snap was bad, did you think that guy was offsides?
Yeah, I don't. Yes, I have no idea. I texted a couple people. I just have no idea why that wasn't called. I mean, you have one official on either side, on either sideline, specifically looking at the line of scrimmage, or the umpire who stands basically where the linebackers do. He also could have made that call, and all three of them missed it. When we kind of finish up and maybe talk about the field conditions and just the bowl in general, you know, maybe have some, you know, a little bit of a knock on the officiating. I wasn't happy with it overall. And yeah, that was not only was he offsides, but I think that was clearly the reason why the snap was bad.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
came on a very key 3rd and short.
Right.
And killed the drive.
Right.
So it definitely had a big impact.
All right. So a couple observations from the offensive line. We saw some extended play from Martez Lewis, you know, the redshirt sophomore. He played some where we've seen him play sparingly, but, you know, he saw some more time in this specific game. But otherwise, any observations in this specific game? We know they didn't run the ball particularly well outside of when Mo was in. And I think some of that was, you know, the game script, and some of it was field conditions and et cetera. I'm not trying to make excuses, but, you know, there were times they were able to lean on and get positive momentum forward for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think on the running side, I would give him a little bit of a break, as you kind of mentioned, in that by midway to end of the first quarter, Syracuse had changed up and was run blitzing and loading the line of scrimmage, which made it difficult for the offensive line to get much much room there. So I don't necessarily put the lack of running success in the last three quarters of the game on their shoulders. But in the passing game, I will knock them a little bit. It needs to be better, specifically on the twists and stunts and blitzes, being able to pick those up cleanly. And I just, again, go back to that's experience. I mean, you have Nathan Bowen there who hasn't seen extended reps, and he has gigantic shoes to fill, you know, going in replacing a consensus All-American. And it's not that Nathan looked out of place or that he wasn't up to the task. He just needs experience. You know, he's in there, and I can, you know, speak as a former offensive lineman. You have to be able to learn the guys next to you how to pass off twists, how to be able to, you know, stay with it, pick things up, and that just takes time. And so that definitely showed in the passing game. Being able, they need to be cleaner pass blocking, certainly.
All right, let's talk about the bowl game in general. I think both of you and I probably are probably going to go on a rant in some way, shape, or form. So I'm going to go first, and then I'm going to let you fill in any details that you feel are necessary.
Sounds good.
First and foremost, bowl games, like to be able to host a bowl game, at a minimum, please have a sufficient playing surface. Like, we're trying to play a game on a grass field in December, where if you didn't know, grass actually goes dormant in winter months, especially in cold northern climates. Like, I mean, every time I watch the Guaranteed Rate Bowl, not the Guaranteed Rate Bowl, but the Pinstripe Bowl, my goodness, the field conditions are terrible. And I don't particularly care about the field position as being terrible as it pertains to like competitive imbalance. I'm more concerned about player health. The fact that, you know, we aren't paying these players, yes, they can now get NIL. And if your argument is like they shouldn't receive payment, well, like this is one of the great reasons that they should, because they're playing on an absolute horrible field for arguably, you know, the benefit of a bowl and those executives that, you know, run that specific bowl, right? Like, come on, the playing surface is terrible. You're risking injury to these players, like putting them in a terrible position. Number two, baseball stadiums and football. I was not there. I don't believe you were there, Derek, but from some of the people that texted me, like the seats they had from an observation perspective were absolutely horrific. Thankfully the stadium was not full, so they were able to move around and actually find where they could actually see a little bit better. But my goodness, that seemed terrible. I know it's cool to be able to be in Yankee Stadium and spend a weekend in New York, but come on now, that's ridiculous. And frankly, now this is two years in a row where the Gophers play in baseball stadiums, in fields. And, you know, last year that the Guaranteed Rate Bowl, you know, the argument was, well, it was wet. I don't know what the argument was this year, because I watched that Wisconsin Guaranteed Rate Bowl win, and the field was atrocious there too. Like, this is bad. This is a bad look for you know, the bowls, but also for the conferences as well, that they're not stepping up and demanding more. Yeah, that's my 2 second rant on bowl games in general, and just the atrocity that's been happening, at least for the Gophers in their last two.
Yeah, you covered a lot, and that I certainly agree with. So I'll try not to be repetitive, but the number one thing, this is now a trend. This is an anomaly. I mean, I will say we were wrong last year. I think many of us were in just chalking up the field conditions in Phoenix to the rain. And I definitely think that contributed to it. But as you mentioned, this year's Guaranteed Rate Bowl, that was also a massive problem. The Pinstripe Bowl, this was not a one-year anomaly. If you've watched any of the previous Pinstripe Bowls, I don't know if it's been as bad, but it's certainly been bad, and it's certainly been a factor. So I guess where I'm at is the players and the fans deserve better. These are Power 5 Division 1 postseason bowl games on national television. And this is, you're really doing a disservice to your fan base and to the student athletes by coming up massively short in this. So if you want to follow, I guess, the money or the protocol or whatever, I mean, it's clear to me that the bowl committees themselves, who are in charge of putting these games on, so just talking here about the Guaranteed Rate and the Pinstripe Bowl, it's clear that either they don't understand what they're doing when it comes to field conditions, or they understand it, but they're not doing anything to change it, because this isn't a one-off. So no. if you follow this through, it is the conference itself that receives the bowl money. So the sponsors and the bowl itself pays the conference. So it's now the onus then becomes on the conference to ensure that this is accountable, that the bowl is accountable to putting on a first-class game. So, yes, this was at best embarrassing and at worst a player safety issue. Either way, however you fall on that spectrum, it's not acceptable for the Big Ten. And then if you want to take it one step further, if the Big Ten Conference isn't going to step in and hold the bowl committees accountable to providing a first-class game, then the coaches and the administrations of the schools themselves need to speak out. They need to step up and either threaten to not accept the bowl bid or accept it under the conditions that changes are going to be made, what have you. And I don't know why this hasn't been addressed earlier. And I would even go a step further and say, just from my selfish fan experience, I think for multiple years in a row, maybe not every single game, I thought the television announcers mailed it in.
Yes.
I don't think they did. They're getting players' names wrong all the time. They don't understand the teams that are playing. I thought that, as you mentioned, the game day experience and some of the seating in these baseball stadiums, I thought the officials were poor. So again, I'll just say, there is the financial model and mechanism for postseason bowl games works. A lot of people watch these games on television. A number of fans go and take part in person in the bowl experience, which is the trip and the destination. The players, I know for sure, really enjoy these experiences and the things they're able to do. And I think the teams like competing. But these bowls themselves, and by extension, the conferences, they need to do better in these situations. They need to step it up. Again, this is, I'll finish with what I started with, which was, this is a Power 5 Division 1 bowl, both of these bowl games, and you need to provide a first-class experience.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And on the officiating, like, it was not good. And I don't watch a lot of Big 12 football, but man, what does both sides, what does a guy got to do to get a hold around here? Like, that was atrocious. It all around, the officiating was not particularly great. We don't talk of a lot of officiating. Ryan often doesn't want to, in large part because he doesn't think the Big Ten's very good, but that was like another level of bad, in my opinion. It was kind of all on its own.
Yeah, I mean, talking about officiating just generally isn't very productive.
Right.
I'm proud of the fact that we don't harp on that. I mean, it certainly is a factor in a number of games, but again, it's just, what are you going to do, right? I mean, then nothing's going to go back and be changed. But I think it is worth bringing up in this case, because again, I would say that I'm not suggesting bias in any way. I'm suggesting laziness.
Yeah.
You know, that it's just, they didn't do a good enough job. And I don't know if that's because the regular season's been over for 3 or 4 weeks or that there's something different in the schedule. I don't know that that's a, you know, that the officials are purposefully doing anything bad. It just needs to be better,
yeah,
one way or another.
And frankly speaking, like, we don't know. Maybe they got, you know, the two head coaches together and they all grabbed Mark Coyle because he hired both head coaches and he said, okay, guys, here's what we're going to do today. Holding's going to kind of be off because the playing field conditions are absolutely atrocious. So if we're going to ever get any successful passes, this is what it's going to require. Like, maybe we missed that, but it was just very, very mind-boggling at times. All right. Generally speaking, I think the only thing else I want to hit on real quick, Derek, is just the fact that, one, we talk a ton about explosive plays and how important they are. And I think now more than ever in the game of college football, especially, they are probably what is going to lead you to success or not. I know you have had some observations to me, but what have you seen this season and even just, you know, the last few seasons in college football?
Yeah, I think that, you know, just upon reflection and just kind of talking schematics, you know, what do we take away? And I think I'll try not to repeat because I think we brought up some of these points throughout the year, but I just think it's worth discussing here briefly is I think it's really clear that explosive plays have never been more important in football. I think that goes for college football and the NFL. I'm a firm believer that success on offense is based on a mixture of consistency and big plays. As an offense, if you're able to be consistent, in other words, moving the chains, doing well on first and second down, putting yourself in an advantageous position on third down, etc., controlling the line of scrimmage, if you're able to do that and have explosive plays, you're usually going to win the game. And of course, you can flip that on defense. If you're able to keep the opposing team from being consistent and limit explosive plays, you're probably going to win the game or win that side of the ball. So it's always been a mixture of that, but I really believe a trend what we're seeing in football over the years and just is continuing is that being consistent has become less important and big plays have become more important. And so I'm just trying to take a page out of PJ Fleck's own book and understand that in order to be successful, you have to recognize change, embrace change, accept it, what have you, or become or die, you know, or become extinct. And so if I'm looking at, you know, kind of taking a step back as a whole and looking at this Minnesota offense, I think it's clear that in order for them to continue with their success and to be even better, I think they need to put a huge emphasis on explosive plays. So great. That sounds good. I think everybody would agree with that. Do they want to see more explosive plays? Of course. So how do you do that? Well, there are really kind of three different ways to generate explosive plays. Number one is just have better athletes. I mean, that's obvious. You're going to organically create explosive plays with better athletes. So you could run inside zone or something up the middle. And if you have, you know, really good offensive line and a really good running back and explosive and fast, et cetera, he's going to break X number of those runs for explosive plays more so than someone who's not as athletic or talented. So that's obvious. Every team in America is trying to become, you know, more athletic, recruit better, et cetera. So I don't know that that's necessarily a strategy that everyone isn't taking. Number two is, you know, take, and I think this is what people normally think of with explosive plays, which is just kind of like taking YOLO shots, right? Mm-hmm. So throwing the ball downfield, finding single coverage, chucking it up. Maybe you could call it a 50-50 ball. You could call it taking shots. And I think, you know, if you're reading the tea leaves from the Gophers press conferences this year, I think that that's what this Gopher coaching staff kind of what they think is synonymous with big plays, which is just, oh, we just take, you know, how many shots are we taking? Yeah. I think that's a factor. I think that we've been critical in the past that, you know, we feel that the Gophers maybe don't do that often enough. I know my own opinion, I really believe that taking those YOLO shots, if you want to call them that, are much less of a risk, I think, than coaches tend to think they are. I think coaches don't do those enough because they think, what if the ball is intercepted? You know, to which I say, if the ball is intercepted 35 yards downfield, that's not really that bad. But I don't know that I'm going to win that argument because I'm not the coach. I'm just a fan. But that's the second part. I think the key here is in the third part. So the other way to generate explosive plays is simply by calling more plays that have a higher tendency or a higher chance of becoming an explosive play. So these would be things like screens, flea flicker, gadget plays, stuff like that. And I don't think you need to necessarily create an identity on offense of, you know, we're going to go full Jeff Brom and we're going to run 10 gadget plays a game. I don't think that's what I'm suggesting here. But if I were the Gopher, part of the Gopher offensive coaching staff, I would make it a goal. I would chart it. I would record it. I would measure it, that we want to generate X number of explosive plays per game. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we need to be calling X number of, type plays that would lend themselves to being explosive. And really, at the end of the game, and then I'll be done here, Luke, with the soapbox, but at the end of the game, if you're able to control the line of scrimmage, control the clock, but lose the game, if you do that and you've taken your shots and not executed on them, that's fine. You live with that. That's football. You know, if you take some shots downfield, you call some screens, you try some creative things, and you're just not able to connect on them, that's execution. You just, you know, you live with that. You tried. But if you're able to control the line of scrimmage, control the time of possession, be consistent on offense, and you lose the game, and you look back and you threw the ball downfield twice, or you threw no screens and no gadget plays and no anything else, shame on you. Mm-hmm. I think in this era of football, I don't think that's acceptable anymore. So that would be one thing, just upon reflection, and an area that I think can be a focus. I have no idea if that's where this is going, and frankly, I don't know if it will or not, but just an observation.
Yeah, I think it's a good observation. And frankly, you know, what we've seen the Gophers do in recruiting is, you know, they've seemingly tried to address gaps that, you know, from a talent perspective, they maybe felt they had in the wide receiver room. I don't necessarily subscribe to the fact now, as we wrap up the season, that there was so much talent deficiency there, as much as it was, you know, calling the plays and putting players in position to be successful. But additionally, I think that as Gopher fans, we have to look at, you know, what are the Gophers saying versus what are they doing, right? And this is more of a coaching thing for me. And one, we see defensively, they almost to a fault do everything to stop explosive plays. Yet offensively, you know, in the era with Mo Ibrahim, they did everything. I shouldn't say that. They seemingly didn't do enough to try and generate explosive plays. And in some ways, that feels like where the big missed opportunity is, right? You know, you look back at the Iowa game, you look back at the Illinois game, you maybe even look back at the Purdue game here, right? Well, and Juan, maybe holding Mo out of that game hurt them too. But in the end, you know, offensively, we're not seeing them try and do what they're trying to stop necessarily. And
yeah, that's what's ironic here.
Yeah, it is. It is the ironic thing. It'll be interesting to see, and I'm going to give them a pass because, frankly speaking, this is the most success I've seen in my lifetime with Gopher football. And they deserve it. Number one, they deserve it. And number two, you know, I want to see if PJ will really truly change his best now that, you know, now that he doesn't have Mo to basically lean on. But that is what is going to make number one, the spring interesting, but you know, this coming fall interesting as well.
Well, there's no doubt that if, I'm not even saying PJ Fleck necessarily, but if a coach were sitting in on the participating in this conversation, there's no den playing devil's advocate. There's no doubt that they would say, you know, things like you have to wrap the offense around the personnel you have. And if you've got Mo Ibrahim, you're going to run the ball. And all of that is valid. I mean, context is important here. And I'm glad you brought it up that none of this should be taken as, well, geez, they're really not getting it done. They really need to do this, this, and this and make wholesale changes. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just looking at this as what are the trends? And I think it goes back to what you said on defense. What we're seeing is we are seeing defenses being built on the assumption that teams are very unlikely to be able to continuously have 13, 14, 15 play drives, dink and dunk, run, down the field for a touchdown. Mm-hmm. Now, there is incredible value in that. And again, if a coach were sitting here, they would be screaming that nothing is more important than being able to control the ball and control the clock in the second half of a game where you have a lead. And that has served Minnesota incredibly well to be able to salt away a game with that 15-play, 7-minute drive in the fourth quarter. Absolutely. It's absolutely invaluable in those cases. So I'm not discounting that. But again, I'll go back one more time to we have to understand the era we're in and know that defenses are saying we are daring you to put together multiple 15 play drives for touchdown. We don't think you can do it because we believe you're going to have a penalty or you're going to have a turnover or something is going to happen that's going to throw that drive off. And you might get 3 or 4 first downs, but you're not going to be able to get 6 first downs and or 5. And so they're betting on that because I think gone are the days of, you know, we're just going to shut down the offense. They're never going to get a first down. We're going to play shutout football. Of course, you'd love to do that, but that's a bygone era. Teams are, the game now has changed, and there's more scoring. There's more offense, and you have to pick your battles on defense. So, again, I just think an emphasis on explosive plays is critical going forward.
I wonder if we should be talking about this more in the way of in the form of like balance, where balance normally used to be like run versus pass, but like if there's some way that we can quantify,
that's a good point.
Yeah, if we can quantify like explosive play versus non-explosive play,
Consistency.
Yeah, versus consistency. Yeah. That's a better way to put it. I'm curious if there's some way that you can quantify that. It may not be possible. But regardless, I do think it would be something that'd be interesting to look into and see at the very least. So I think you're onto a point there in terms of your observation. I am curious to see, you know, what the Gophers are going to do. And frankly, one of the things I love about college football is the fact that, you know, we're effectively going to have a whole new roster next year. And you know, it's going to be a whole new challenge. The Big Ten West is going to change drastically in its final form. Right. And it should be a very, very fun offseason, you know, to talk about and cover. Maybe just lastly, Derek, you know, give us kind of an update on Dinkytown Athletes, you know, where things are at, and, you know, how important Dinkytown Athletes is to the sustainability of college athletics at the University of Minnesota.
Oh yeah. Well, first of all, want to thank everybody that's hopped on board and become a member of Dinkytown Athletes. It's made an impact. We're very, very happy with being able to get this going and support the student athletes. It is making a difference. We are set up to be able to support student athletes in all different sports, not just football, but, you know, specifically in football, we've had a lot of people join as members with, you know, and say that I want my membership to support football, and we're set up to handle that. So first and foremost, just wanted to say thank you there. You know, secondly, NIL in general, you know, we could probably do a whole nother podcast on that, but I think, you know, the data points that are coming in with NIL are interesting. There's certainly a ton of speculation going on, and I would say a fair amount of negativity, if I'm being honest, about whether it's people thinking, well, how is my team going to be able to compete in the NIL era? You know, we've got no chance. How do we compete against helmet schools? You're hearing about 6- and 7-figure contracts going around, and I think that's discouraging for people. And I think the point, if anybody takes something away from this that I want people to hear, is I believe after being involved in this now for 6 months, I believe that the way we can be successful, our path to success at supporting a school like the University of Minnesota, is in creating numbers and a groundswell of memberships and a grassroots effort. And I don't think it's as daunting as people think. And I'll repeat what I said a few episodes ago, which is, look at the math this way. There are 24,000 season ticket holders for Gopher football alone, just for football. If a portion of those become a member at the entry level of $10 a month, there are a number of membership levels. It's like a Patreon model. You get different perks at different levels. If let's just say less than half of those season ticket holders become members, that is going to make an incredible impact. It already is making an impact with the people that have already hopped on board, but that's what we're not where we need to be ultimately. I mean, we have a lot of room to grow, and the path to get there is to grow through the core fan base, the people that are season ticket holders, or the people that watch the games every Saturday, that you know, are, you know, some level of passionate fan, to be able to hop on board and become a member for $10 a month or more, depending on whatever level suits you, that is going to make a difference. And then you can say you've done your part, you know, that you've done your part to support the student athletes, and you, whatever happens, happens at that point. And it's up to all of us to come together and do what we can. And I don't think it's as daunting and as overwhelming as people are making it seem.
All right, Derek, appreciate you and all the work that you and Ra were doing with Dinkytown Athletes and the entire Dinkytown Athletes team. More importantly, thank you for joining us this season and breaking down games. It's always fun to get your perspective. You have a really unique perspective having played the game, but just how you look at games, you know, schematically. Appreciate your contributions to our lowly little podcast here. Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. I appreciate you guys having me back for another season. I love being a fan of college football, and I want to just go back for a second to something you said a couple episodes ago, which was college football, I think, it's about memories. You know, it's about mm-hmm. creating memories with other college football, with friends, family, multi-generational. One gentleman, I'm not sure if it was on Gopher Illustrated or Twitter, but I think that you brought up to me was – you had talked about how it's about traditions and, you know, and family and things like that. And one gentleman said that his last memories with his father, who had suffered a stroke, his last memories pre-stroke were enjoying Gopher football games together. So that, I mean, that says it right there.
Yeah.
I mean, being able to share things like that is one of the great, great things about college football.
Yeah. And I think I've actually gotten better at kind of articulating my feelings on this. I've never been able to put words about it, but my wife is someone who doesn't really like sports in general. And she's never really understood, you know, my love for it. And recently I found that, you know, in the end, to me, what I love about sports is the shared experience. And I think that's what actually makes life wonderful. I'm not saying just about sports, but just shared experiences. And that's how we build great memories. And frankly, I am thankful that we have sports to be able to, you know, bring us together and create shared memories. In the end, I'll look back fondly, you know, yes, at some of the games, but probably more importantly, the experiences together. And one of that is being able to do this podcast with you and Ryan and talking through all these games. And if you see any of us in the community or around, come and say hi. Don't say hi to Ryan because he's actually very much an introvert. But come and say hi to me. I'm an extreme extrovert. Really, really enjoy connecting with people. So say hi. And yeah, it's been so fun to do this year. Derek, appreciate your contributions as well. Again, thank you for listening to Gopher Gridiron Radio, and go Gophers.